is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I've survived. You have lost a brain. That's God's plan. It's been nothing in this world. But the bad guys are bad.
That's Ugandan Transport Minister and former Defense Force Chief General Edward Katumba Wamala speaking from the hospital after an attack by motorcycle gunmen who injured him and killed his daughter and driver. Details coming up. Also, the UN World Food Program is providing emergency assistance to Ethiopia's Tigray region. And 350,000 people affected by the volcanic eruption in Goma, DRC, are in urgent need of assistance. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. In South Africa, scientists are concerned that a third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic could be worse than previous outbreaks. The country is already the worst affected in Africa by the coronavirus, with 1.7 million confirmed infections and more than 56,000 deaths. Darren Taylor reports.
New infections in South Africa are up to an average of almost 4,000 a day, from around 1,000 2 months ago. Vaccines are finally being rolled out, but nowhere near the speed needed to make a significant impact on reducing the power of the third wave. Dr. Ridwan Suleiman, a scientist at the Center for Scientific and Industrial Research, says although authorities aren't testing enough people, it's enough to confirm that South Africa's entering a dangerous new phase of the pandemic.
We're finding a positive test for every 9 to 10 tests conducted. As this test positivity rate continues to increase, it also starts to show an indication that there may be more undetected or unreported cases.
He says some provinces are reporting increases of positive tests of between 10 and 15% from around 4% just a month ago.
All of those are really a concern. Remember, below 5% is safe, between 5 and 10% is a worry, and above 10% really is a concern.
Suleiman says the statistics also mean a spike in hospital admissions, especially in South Africa's biggest city, Johannesburg.
Hospitalizations there have increased by 38% compared to a week ago.
His center's research shows almost 90 people dying from COVID-19 every day. But, adds Suleiman, this number may be higher, as there's a delay in processing data, and he expects the figure to be quite a bit more soon. In an effort to restrict the impact of the third wave, the government's announced tighter restrictions, such as limiting gatherings to 100 people indoors and 250 outdoors. Dr. Aslam Dasu of the Progressive Health Forum says this won't prevent so-called super spreader events.
I would have preferred something closer to below 50, closer to 20. I think this would have been possible if we were to prevail over the major social lobbies like the religious groups and others, where we see a huge degree of complacency, as much as they may be trying.
In many regions of the country, churches, mosques, bars and restaurants continue to be packed with no social distancing. Dasu wants all in South Africa to wake up from pandemic fatigue.
The message is don't get sick. If you can internalize that message and take the measures that will avoid you getting infected, you will end up protecting a very beleaguered health system. You know, the wave is still peak, so we can expect much more pressure on an already high-pressure situation.
As the pressure mounts, Dasu continues to add his voice to many others demanding that the government boosts numbers of vaccinations.
At the moment, the government is the only procurer of vaccine. South Africa has the dubious distinction of being one of the countries with the lowest vaccination rates in the world and one of the highest mortality rates. That's a correlation.
Yet, says Dasu, there are big aid organizations and corporations offering to help bring in what the country really needs, more vaccines. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The UN's World Food Programme says it will scale up emergency food assistance in Ethiopia's Tigray region to reach 2.1 million people. Since April, WAFP says it has managed to access all 13 districts of northwestern Tigray and has just kicked off a second six-week round of aid by adding five new districts in southern Tigray to its operational areas. According to WFP, a total of 5.2 million people, 91% of Tigray's population, need emergency food assistance due to conflict since last November. The UN organization says it needs $203 million to continue to scale up its response in Tigray to save lives and livelihood through the end of the year. Aid agencies say 350,000 people affected by the eruption of Mount Nyiragongo near the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo are in need of urgent assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Mount Nyiragongo erupted on May 22nd, turning the sky a fiery red and spewing lava into nearby villages. More than 30 people were killed. Fears of a second volcanic eruption caused a mass exodus from Goma of most of its 450,000 residents on May 27th. Around a quarter of that population fled to the neighboring town of Sake in the eastern province of North Kivu. The UN Refugee Agency left behind a team of nine people in the area to evaluate the needs of the displaced. The agency and partners immediately began distributing plastic sheeting, water, and other aid. The head of the UNHCR office in Goma, Jackie Keegan, says she and her team since have returned to Goma. Speaking on a video link, she describes the situation in the city as one of uncertainty and unease.
Yes, I'm scared of the aftershocks, of course. Less scared now than I was when the windows were shaking every minute, which was happening about 4 days ago. But it's scary. We're living on an active volcano. Like everybody else who ran away from the volcano, we are trying to figure out how to be as useful as possible in a challenging time.
The International Organization for Migration reports the eruption has displaced more than 415,000 people, nearly half of them minors. Most have traveled to towns in the eastern DRC, while roughly 52,000 have crossed the border into Rwanda. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says about a quarter of those who have fled Goma are very vulnerable and in need of special aid. These groups, he says, include breastfeeding women, the chronically ill, pregnant women, unaccompanied children, the elderly, and the disabled.
Should the displacement last, it's essential that we consider how we're going to prevent the spread of epidemics, facilitate humanitarian assistance, and get kids back to school. IOM is particularly concerned by the health hazards linked to the eruption itself, the displacement to areas with pre-existing outbreaks, the lack of access to clean water, and the increased burden placed on health facilities.
Aid agencies warn that people in Goma are at increased risk of cholera, which is endemic in the region and easily spread in areas with poor hygiene and sanitation and insufficient clean water. The World Food Programme reports it has started providing emergency food rations to thousands of people displaced from Goma. Based on assessments carried out over the past week, the WFP says it aims to reach 165,000 people in three cities of refuge. It says additional emergency food assistance is being provided to Congolese who have gone to Rwanda. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Animosity clearly remains high between Libya's warring factions. The High Council of State has denounced a military parade in Benghazi Saturday, saying it was organized by what it called irregular and illegal forces led by war criminal Khalifa Haftar. For his part, Haftar said, there is no peace with terrorists and the war is not over. Meanwhile, the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum failed to reach an agreement on a constitutional basis for the December elections. Wolfgang Poschdai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these challenges with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The parade was certainly to underline the still remaining influence of Haftar and somehow also to demonstrate the unity and the military power of the East. It was on the occasion of the 7th anniversary of Operation Dignity. This was the military operation which retook Benghazi from the Islamists in an extremely bloody battle which lasted for more than 3 years. What remains in the mind of the Easterners is that with more than 15,000 killed on both sides, this was by far the bloodiest battle on Libyan soil since World War II. And Haftar is serving, of course, these grievances. The chair of the Presidential Council, Al-Menfi, and Prime Minister Dbeibah were invited to the parade, but they preferred to go on trips abroad. Quite remarkable. The House of Representatives chair, Aguila Saleh, who is from the East, stayed away without giving a specific reasoning, demonstrating, I would say, some personal distance from Haftar. It is quite telling which politicians attended, namely the Deputy Prime Minister Al-Qadrani and several other ministers and deputy ministers from the East. During his speech, Haftar pledged his full support for the elections in December. He said that direct election of the president is a right of the people, but at the same time, while giving these peaceful wordings, he demanded the dissolution of all armed groups in Tripoli and threatened again to use force to achieve this. But during the three-hour parade, the LNA did not show any new equipment which could be a game-changer in an eventual renewed large offensive. So the LNA still lacks a real offensive capability. With regard to the LPDF, UN Special Representative Kubisch was not very pleased with the outcome, and he referred all the open questions to the House of Representatives, the legitimate parliament. They should find a solution until preferably June 20 in consent with the rival High Council of State. Well, that's not really an easy task, especially as the House of Representatives is not really famous for finding quick solutions. Libya is certainly again at a critical time right now.
The U.S. Ambassador and Special Envoy to Libya, Richard Norland, reviewed Saturday in a meeting with the head of the Libyan Presidential Council, Mohammed Menfi, the unification of military, security and other institutions in Libya, national reconciliation, removal of foreign fighters and elections in December. What could the U.S. do to help Libya achieve these goals?
First, they should be realistic about further reunifications. Much has already been achieved right now. The National Oil Corporation and the Central Bank of Libya are already unified. A reunification of the military and the security forces less than 1 year after the last major fighting is over is simply not realistic. I don't know any example of a civil war-torn country where such an endeavor has worked. Also, withdrawal of foreign forces and mercenaries before the elections is highly unlikely. What is achievable is a consolidation of the ceasefire by the establishment of a credible international monitoring mission. And this should be one of the main focuses of the United States, just as establishing some kind of insurance. Continued pressure to hold elections, not only on Libyan political leaders, but also on the international stakeholders who benefit a lot from the current government, is mandatory, especially on Turkey and Qatar. One needs to remember that President Erdogan has presidential elections coming up in early 2023. He cannot afford to get eventually a not-so-friendly president of Libya the year before. So I guess Turkey is not so eager to have elections in Libya anytime soon. The United States should support the preparation of the elections. They should encourage the Libyans to go to vote, and they should contribute to monitoring the elections within the framework of the United Nations. And they should keep in mind, even if the elections can be held successfully in December, it's not over yet. Libya would not become a stable country overnight.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The leader of the Polisario Front, Brahim Ghali, has testified by video in a Spanish court about allegations against that he was involved in torture, genocide, and other crimes. The Polisario Front is a movement that has long sought to end Morocco's control over the Western Sahara after it was annexed in the 1970s. Ghali's lawyer told the Associated Press that Morocco's allegations are part of an effort to discredit the Polisario and said he would file a request for the charges to be dismissed. The Polisario leader is being treated in a hospital in northern Spain after being diagnosed with COVID-19. The Spanish government says Ghali's stay in Spain is a humanitarian gesture. This has angered Morocco and led Rabat to relax border controls, which allowed thousands of migrants to enter Spain's North African enclave of Ceuta. Uganda's army spokesman says unidentified gunmen attacked the transport minister and former defense forces chief, General Edward Katumba Wamala, while he was traveling in an army vehicle with his daughter yesterday. The army says he was injured while his daughter and driver were killed. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
The former Chief of Defense Forces General Edward Katumba Wamala was leaving his home in an Army Land Cruiser when unknown assailants traveling on two motorcycles shot at the vehicle, according to authorities. Brigadier Flavia Wekwaso, the Army spokesperson, spoke to VOA about the incident.
The assailants riding on border borders shot at his vehicle. The occupants of the car, including his daughter, and the driver died on spot. At this point in time, I can't tell whether it was an attempted assassination. The investigation has already started, and they shall be releasing the details as they come in.
The general, who is mainly referred to as Katumba, is now being treated for his injuries at a hospital cordoned off by the army. Katumba spoke to two other daughters from his hospital bed.
I've survived. We have lost a brain. That's God's plan. It's been nothing to this world, but the bad guys are bad. God has given me a second chance. I pulled through. Don't worry, I don't have bad injuries, only the arms, but I'll be fine. I'm with the doctors, and the doctors have done everything possible.
This will be the 37th such attack since 2015. The 36 previous ones ended with the deaths of the targeted victims, including a police spokesperson, Muslim clerics, and a state prosecutor, Joan Kagezi, who was working on an Al-Shabaab attack-related murder trial. Kagezi was the lead prosecutor in the trial of 13 men accused of the 2010 bombings in Kampala, in which 76 people were killed while watching the World Cup. General Katumba was chief of defense forces from 2013 to 2017. He also became Inspector General Police in 2001. Katumba was the first military officer to serve with the police. Katumba is the outgoing Works and Transport Minister. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The government of Botswana says self-screening HIV tests are legal. Its announcement comes amid concerns the use of the home kits in a country with the world's third highest HIV prevalence could lead to a spike in suicides. Human rights organizations argue the use of home tests violates ethics on HIV. From Habrone, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
A non-governmental organization is among a number of civic groups that are raising concern over the use of the kits. The Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV, Bonela, says allowing patients to test themselves could lead to a rise in suicide cases. In a statement, Bonela argues that counseling is mandatory for all patients who are tested for the virus, but the group says that's not the case for patients who use the home tests who have not been provided such support. Human rights lawyer and former Bonela director, Weyapondadi, wants the government to hold the use of the kids. He says their use violates the Public Service Health Act and all HIV tests should be done at health facilities. Habron-based HIV activist Oren Gilibonyam says the self-screening tests serve their purpose, but caution must be exercised.
It is a genuine concern that people might commit suicide after testing positive. Some conduct these home tests alone and there is no one to offer counseling. There is still a lot of stigma attached to HIV. Therefore, we should be careful how we handle the issue. It is a good initiative that the government wants more people to test, but we must be careful how we do it.
The government, in a statement, says the home kits are not against the law. Minister of Health spokesperson Christopher Nyanga says the tests are simply meant for screening for the presence of HIV in an individual. He says this is different from diagnostic tests, which are supposed to be carried out by a health professional. Nyanga says the government, in a bid to encourage HIV testing, introduced the home kits for cases where partners are not able to travel to health facilities. Officials say health workers who distribute the tests are expected to carefully explain
explains instructions and precautions to those who use them. But they emphasize that while the home tests may help determine the health status of the person using them, they are not conclusive. The government says those who use the kits should still confirm the results at government-run facility. Botswana has the world's third highest HIV prevalence behind Eswatini and Lesotho. However, the country has been praised for putting more than 250 of its citizens on life-saving antiretroviral therapies. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
Zimbabwe is imposing measures which analysts say are intended to force transactions in the local currency instead of U.S. dollars. But experts warn that the effort could backfire and fuel inflation. Adigando has more on the story.
The government recently published a statute which sets fines for pricing goods and services only in foreign exchange, refusing to accept payments in local currency and selling goods for a price above the official exchange rate. And participants in the regular forex auctions can also be fined for not using the money for its stated purpose. They are the latest moves to shore up the battered local currency and bolster the economy. Both were already in trouble before COVID-19 lockdowns made things even worse. Analysts say, while some of the measures appear to be reasonable, punishing businesses for pricing goods above the auction rate is being criticized as price control and could cause a spike in inflation and other economic damage. After an effort to de-dollarize the economy largely failed, Zimbabwe introduced a multi-currency system 2 years ago due to economic pressures from liquidity challenges. It also introduced the foreign exchange auction system in a bid to shore up scant reserves needed to pay for essential goods and discourage the black market. The government has lauded the system for stabilizing inflation, even though the central bank says the year-to-year figure inflation for May stood still at 161%. But observers say the system has failed to kill the black market, where the U.S. dollar is fetching between 115 to 130 Zimbabwe dollars compared with 82 at the official rate. Businesses tended to encourage consumers to buy goods with the U.S. dollar using the parallel market rate. Now, with the new measure, the government appears to be saying no more discount for customers paying in foreign currency. A SNAP survey around Bulawayo revealed that prices shot up by over 30% just a day after the announcement. A bottle of cooking oil, which was selling for US$3.80, is now going for around $5. Economic analyst Oswald Bina says although the new rules may be well-intended and meant to shift the pricing regime away from the parallel market, there are challenges.
The unintended consequences are that, one, a wholesome rejection of dual pricing in the economy, predominantly driven by the uncertainties presented by the use of the local currency. So you'd find that players may incline more to using local currency, but at exorbitant markup to safeguard themselves from the uncertainties around the use of the local currency.
Analysts believe that the parallel market will be strengthened rather than shaken by the recent moves, forcing consumers to buying basics rather than paying more with a hard-earned foreign exchange in the formal market. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehisu Hibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.